The dialogue titled The Phaedo, the third in the trilogy about Socrates' last days, describes Socrates' execution itself and the conversation he had with his friends just before he died. These events are portrayed years after they occurred by Phaedo, a friend of Socrates who'd been present at the time. The setting is the same prison where Crito talked with Socrates. The ships return to Athens, and the death sentence is now to be carried out. Crito is there again, together with Phaedo and other friends of his. The group enters the prison just after Socrates' chains have been removed. His wife, Xanthippe, and his young son have arrived earlier, and Socrates now asks Crito to take them home. He wants to discuss with his friends, for one last time, the significance of what is happening. To the end, Socrates is committed to the examined life. Here he wants to reflect on death as a part of that life. Socrates begins the dialogue with a startling description of the relation between death and philosophy. He tells his friends that it's foolish to think of death as an evil. Philosophy itself is a rehearsal for dying. Why, Socrates asks, should someone devote his life to examining truth and then be afraid of that truth when he encounters it face to face?
People who really apply themselves in the right way to philosophy are directly and of their own accord preparing themselves for dying and death. If this is true, it would, of course, be absurd to be troubled when the thing comes for which they have so long been preparing and looking forward.
Socrates' friends are puzzled by this odd description of philosophy, but they're not too perplexed to find the irony in it. So Simmias, one of the friends, replies,
"Upon my word, Socrates, you have made me laugh, though I was not at all in the mood for it. I am sure that if they heard what you said, most people would heartily agree that it was a very good hit at the philosophers to say that they are half dead already, and that they, the normal people, are quite aware that death would serve the philosophers right."
But Socrates responds that the people who say this are right for the wrong reason. In fact, they don't understand what philosophy is. They don't even know what death is. Certainly they miss the connection between them. Philosophy depends on the use of reason, and reason can be free only when it's not hindered by feelings or emotions, by the interference of the senses. In other words, the mind must be left to follow its own course, something that's unlikely as long as feelings or emotions intrude. Because of this, philosophy emphasizes the importance of separating the body from the soul, and it's that kind of dying that Socrates is urging on his friends. To show what he means here, he reminds them of certain ideals or principles that he's mentioned before. There are obvious differences between feelings and ideas, between the senses and reason. Our senses are attached to our bodies. What we learn from the senses is just as changeable as the bodies themselves. Genuine knowledge, on the other hand, doesn't change. This means that the objects of knowledge, in other words, what we know, must also be constant and fixed. It's in these terms that Socrates begins to question Simmias.
Do we say, Simmias, that there is such a thing as justice?
We do say so, certainly.
And such things as the good and the beautiful?
Of course.
And did you ever see one of them with your eyes or any other of the body's senses?
Never.
The direction of Socrates' arguments becomes clear. We discover ideals or general principles and definitions through reason. Anything that blocks this process should be avoided. In human experience, the senses and the emotions obstruct reason, so philosophy is a practice for dying. As reason constantly distances itself from the body and its senses, and what is this distancing but a form of dying? Socrates speaks here of dying as a metaphor. His friends, however, focused on the execution, are thinking of death not metaphorically, but literally. Socrates is speaking even at the end about the life of philosophy. His friends are concerned about the difference that physical death makes, even to the soul or mind. And so, on his last day, as often before, Socrates finds himself in a philosophical tug-of-war. His friends still have to be convinced that reason and the soul are indeed different from matter and body, that the mind does not have physical properties, and certainly that the mind does not have a beginning or an end. The friends believe that Socrates is speaking here about the physical existence of a soul that might continue to live after death, and they're both skeptical and fearful. They press Socrates with some of the standard objections to the idea of immortality. So, for example, Kebes argues that the soul is only a harmony of parts of the body, a harmony which disintegrates when the body does. Even if the soul is more than a harmony and exists before the body, he adds, this doesn't mean that it would survive death. For if a single soul reappeared in a number of bodies, here Kebes refers to the idea of reincarnation, which was a fairly common belief, the soul itself would sooner or later wear out or disintegrate. So Simmias objects,
a tailor makes and wears out any number of coats, but although he outlives all the others, presumably he perishes before the last one. And this does not mean that a man is inferior to a coat or has a weaker hold on life, but still the soul may die, leaving behind its latest covering or body.
Socrates responds patiently to these objections. His friends need reassurance much more than he does. Kebes openly admits the fears they feel.
Probably even in us adults there is a little boy who has these childish terrors. You should try, Socrates, to persuade that little boy not to be afraid of death as though it were something awful.
And Socrates does indeed attempt to give them courage, appealing to their emotions and to their reason. He cautions them against becoming skeptical of all arguments just because there seem to be many conflicting ones that are plausible.
We must not let it enter our minds that there may be no validity in argument. On the contrary, we should recognize that the faults of defective arguments are in us, and we must brace ourselves and try to heal ourselves.
Does Socrates believe that the soul is immortal? Well, undoubtedly he does. But even in his last hours, he's less concerned with the soul's fate after the body physically dies. He's more concerned with the soul's activity in life. On this point, Socrates is unequivocal. There is a radical difference between mind and body, between reason and matter. This difference is even more important in life than in death, and the proof is close by. Socrates is now in prison, awaiting execution, having rejected the opportunity to escape. How can that be explained, he asks.
Suppose that someone were to tell me that the reason I sit here now is that my body consists of bone and muscle, so that when the bones are raised in their sockets, the muscles slackening and tightening enable me to bend my limbs. And for this cause I sit here now.
Socrates strongly challenges this explanation.
You can be certain that these bones and muscles would have been far away by now if it were not for my belief that it was better and more just to submit to the sentence that my city gives than to take to my heels and run.
The reason Socrates sits in prison is altogether different from the physical cause for sitting there. This is the difference between a decision of the mind and a response of the body.
A philosopher's soul will not first expect to be set free by philosophy and then allow pleasure and pain to reduce it once more to bondage, thus taking upon itself an endless task, like Penelope when she undid her own weaving. No, this soul secures immunity from its desires by following reason and abiding always in her company and by contemplating the true and divine.
If the mind or soul acts differently from the body, this could only be because they are different. Socrates wants to make certain his friends are persuaded of this truth, even if they don't understand it. In addition to satisfying their reason, the little boy in them has to be comforted. So he finally tells them a story, which, like so many fables, mingles fact and fiction. In this story, Socrates describes how souls are judged after they die. Those who've acted wickedly are punished. Those who've lived good lives are rewarded. Those whose lives have been mixed are both punished and rewarded. As a result, souls are cured of their wickedness. The truth in this myth, Socrates suggests, is that people are responsible for the lives they lead. Whatever circumstances they find themselves in, their power of reason enables them to decide what they will do about those circumstances. This truth applies to life. Whether there's literally also a judgment after death is a separate question. And Socrates' words here tell us something more about his method.
No reasonable man ought to insist that the facts are exactly as I have described them, but that either this or something like it is a true account of our souls. This, I think, is a reasonable contention and a belief worth risking, for the risk is a noble one. We should use such accounts to inspire ourselves with confidence.
After he tells this story, time grows short, and Socrates begins to prepare himself for the executioner. Even then, after all he has said, his friends aren't entirely convinced. Their doubts come out in an odd way. How shall we bury you? Crito asks, and Socrates replies teasingly,
however you want. That is, if you catch me and I don't escape you. I can't persuade Crito that I am this Socrates here, who is talking to you now and marshaling all the arguments. He thinks that I am the one whom he will see presently lying dead. No, you must keep up your spirits and say that it is only my body that you are burying. And you can bury it as you please, in whatever way you think is proper.
Soon afterwards, the jailer brings the cup of hemlock that is to be the means of execution. Socrates drinks the poison and then follows the jailer's instructions to walk up and down till he feels he has to lie down. Crito, Socrates says, we owe a cock to Asclepius. And so he again reminds his friends, with his last words, that his death is actually a form of healing. He asks them to make a sacrifice in his behalf to the god of healing. Phaedo, the narrator of the dialogue, then concludes his account of the scene and of Socrates.
This was the end of our comrade. A man, as we should say, of all then living, the noblest and the wisest and the most just.
It's certain that Plato rearranged his description of Socrates' last days. But Plato's portrait of ethics in action is compelling, apart from this historical issue. It is possible, we learn, to value moral principle more than life itself. This becomes clear in Socrates' life and death. In addition to Plato's description of the philosophical life in action, he also lays out for his readers a number of arguments about certain central questions of ethics. These questions themselves constitute a pattern. What do we need to learn or know in order to make ethical decisions? How can that be learned or taught? What's the relation between knowledge and moral character? What, by contrast, is the source of wrongdoing or evil? And finally, the most fundamental question, why should a man live according to ethical values? The last of these questions recurs in many of Plato's dialogues. It's usually raised by a speaker who's convinced that wrongdoing or crime pays better than pursuing justice or doing good. But the question itself needs to be questioned. It seems to demand an ethical reason for being ethical. It asks, why should I or anyone be moral? But if ethical values themselves are being questioned, it hardly seems possible to give an ethical reason to justify them. Many philosophers since Plato have concluded that there is no basis outside of ethics itself for acting morally. But for Plato, the moral life is closely tied to reason. He believes that reason's the distinguishing feature of human nature. And therefore, man can know and do what is good only by applying reason itself. Indeed, by acting in accordance with reason and the good, people fulfill their true nature. It's by doing this that the command of the Delphic oracle, know thyself, will be obeyed. This reason-oriented view of human nature underlies a number of perplexing statements Plato makes about the difference between good and evil.
An evil person can never harm a good person. It is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. One should never repay evil with evil.
All of these assertions contradict common beliefs and common practice, but Plato clearly intends to do this. He was obviously aware that wrongdoing often has harsh, painful consequences for its victims, But he asserts one thing an evildoer can't do is to make a good person evil. If that were possible, it would be the very worst thing anyone could do to someone else. But it can't be done. Only we ourselves determine whether we will act justly or unjustly. Furthermore, the evildoer harms himself most of all, because wrongdoing goes against both reason and nature. Plato says that to act justly is the most important way in which man can live in accordance with nature. In this way, happiness can be achieved, too, since we're happy only when our natural inclinations and capacities are fully realized. So Plato repeatedly speaks out in the dialogues against those who look at the world around them and conclude that wrongdoing pays.
This alone stands steadfast, that we should be more on our guard against doing than suffering wrong, and that before all things a man should study not to seem, but to be good, whether in private or in public life, and that if anyone proves evil in any way, he should be chastised. Next to being good, the second best thing is to become good, and to make amends by accepting one's punishment. You may let anyone despise you as a fool and do you outrage if he wishes, yes, and you may cheerfully let him strike you with that humiliating blow, for you will suffer no harm thereby, if you really are a good and honorable man.
Plato believes that ethical actions are both reasonable and natural, but it may seem that he underestimates the powerful attraction of wrongdoing. The wrongdoer often seems to get ahead of those who act justly. Often he seems to find pleasure in his actions and their consequences. But for Plato, neither of these assumptions is convincing. He says wrongdoing brings illusory benefits. In fact, such benefits harm the receiver. The pleasure that seems to accompany wrongdoing soon becomes tyrannical. It turns into a desire for satisfaction that can never be satisfied. Here again, Plato stresses the power of reason. If people really know what the good is, they won't be able to go against that knowledge.
The lover of wisdom will himself become orderly and divine in the measure permitted to man, and a compulsion is laid upon him to practice stamping on the plastic matter of human nature, in public and private, the patterns that he envisions.
Knowledge begins with self-knowledge. Together, they provide the key to ethics for Plato. Here, as elsewhere, Plato's confidence in reason is overwhelming. He asserts that to know the good is to do the good. This means that whoever really knows what's morally right will then be impelled to do it. And the converse of this also holds. Whatever anyone does, he does because he thinks it's good. So Plato writes,
even when we slaughter, or banish from the city, or deprive of property, we do not simply will these acts. We will the good. Not what is neither good nor evil, nor what is evil. Even the worst tyrant surely does what seems good to him.
People may be mistaken in judging their own actions, but at least they think that what they're doing is right. Otherwise, Plato concludes, they wouldn't do it. How then does evil or wrongdoing happen? People do wrong, Plato suggests, not because they want to, but out of ignorance. Either they're unaware of what the good is, or they don't realize what they're doing. Maybe both.
If acting unjustly is harmful to the wrongdoer, is it not knowledge of what he is doing that would prevent this act? And does this not mean, once again, that no one voluntarily does wrong, but that all who do wrong do so against their own will?
Wrongdoing has no positive features. It's always a failure or absence. In fact, evil's not even quite real. It's a shadow of the good that might have been. People who do wrong don't act willingly or wittingly. They do so quite simply because they don't know any better. Predictably, this view of evil has consequences for Plato's conception of punishment. If a wrong were done knowingly, then punishment would be justified, either as retribution, paying back the wrongdoer, or as a deterrent, making life so painful that he won't repeat the act. But if wrongs are done because of ignorance, the wrongdoer is not really responsible for what he does. So Plato concludes his punishment should be a form of rehabilitation, educating him to recognize the true nature of the good.
The wicked man and the doer of evil is, in any case, unhappy. But he is more unhappy if he does not meet with justice and suffer punishment. Less unhappy if he pays the penalty and suffers punishment.
Only with this punishment and the self-knowledge it brings will the wrongdoer then become fully responsible for what he does, whether it's evil or good. Punishment, then, should be designed to educate, and the task here, it seems, is not very different from the more general task of leading people from ignorance to knowledge. How, then, can we acquire the knowledge we need to act ethically? On the one hand, if people are rational by nature, then they should also be naturally good. In Plato's view, it's reasonable to act in accordance with the good. And if people are naturally good, learning to act justly will be unnecessary. They'll already know this. On the other hand, Plato's aware that people often do act wrongly or unjustly. But the lack of knowledge that explains this also comes from inside ourselves. Nobody can give someone else the power of reason. No one can make someone else do what is wrong. Furthermore, Plato says knowledge can't simply be transferred like a message or a possession, nor can knowledge be bought or sold. In this sense, in fact, neither ethics nor anything else can be taught. This, again, is why Socrates wouldn't accept fees for his teaching. He didn't want people to think they could buy knowledge. Both reason and knowledge come from inside the knower. The role of the teacher, for ethics, as for all other knowledge, is then only to provoke the student into teaching himself, to sting him, just as Socrates, in his role as the gadfly of Athens, had done in his life. Plato's so committed to this view of teaching and learning that he asks us to accept a rather fanciful explanation for it. He says people have knowledge, all knowledge, in themselves, innately. It's born in them. But for some reason, Plato suggests, at birth, this innate knowledge is forgotten. Teachers, then, are supposed to remind their students of what they already know but have forgotten. Plato admits he's telling a tall tale when he says that innate knowledge has been forgotten. But he tells this story to justify his theory of teaching and learning, which is much more important to him. Plato's myth also recalls Socrates in his self-pronounced role of gadfly. He made people remember what they'd rather forget. In the dialogue entitled The Meno, Plato puts together the many pieces of this theory of learning, relating the theory to an analysis of ethics. The dialogue opens with a question Meno puts to Socrates.
Can you tell me, Socrates, whether virtue can be taught? Or if not, does it come by practice? Or does it come neither by practice nor by teaching? But perhaps people have it by nature, or instill some other way.
How, in other words, does a man become good or virtuous? Socrates responds characteristically by challenging Meno's assumption that he already knows what virtue is. He urges Meno to answer that question before going on to consider whether virtue can be taught or not. And Meno shows that Socrates' doubts are well-founded. He first tries to define virtue by offering a list of examples.
A man's virtue is to manage public business, to help friends and hurt enemies. A woman's virtue is to manage the house well and keep the stores all safe and obey her husband.
Socrates quickly notices Meno's mistake. You can't define what something is by giving examples of it, because you need the definition before you can find the examples. Otherwise, how would you know where to look? Socrates asks Meno,
suppose I ask you what a bee is. What is its essential nature? And you replied that bees were of many different kinds. What I want you to tell me is not that they are different, or even how they are different, but how they are all the same.
In Plato's view, Meno's made a common error. This error is evidence that general principles exist. Plato says particular examples imply that there is something common among them. The goal of all science is to determine what that common something is. This is true for all kinds of knowing. So it also applies to the understanding of ethical or moral values like justice or courage or piety. So it's crucial to discover what this group of ethical qualities have in common. But this is not easily accomplished. Meno himself points to one difficulty when he describes a dilemma that might block the way to all knowledge and learning.
How will you try to find out something, Socrates, when you have no notion at all of what it is? If you meet it by chance, how will you know this is that which you did not know?
In other words, if you know something, you don't have to learn it. If you don't know it, you won't be able to recognize it when you do learn it. According to this dilemma, learning of any sort would be impossible. Socrates responds first by telling Meno a myth he's heard. Then he gives what amounts to a practical demonstration of the myth. The myth, according to Socrates, describes the soul or mind as immortal. And if a soul is immortal and rational, it knows everything that can be known. More exactly, everything knowable is included in the soul. When the soul's born into a body, however, it forgets what it's previously known. The knowledge is still there, but the newborn infant doesn't have access to it. The infant then seems to begin anew from the beginning. But in fact, the way it learns is by a process of recollecting or remembering what it previously knew. In this sense, learning and teaching do not provide the student with new information. They only prod him to recall what he already knows. Socrates provides an example of what he means here by giving an impromptu geometry lesson to a slave boy who belongs to Meno. He encourages the boy to answer some questions and claims that the boy finds in himself the geometric proof they eventually produce. Socrates, with his reminders, clearly asks what we would call leading questions. But he emphasizes to Meno that the boy's answers come not from Socrates or from any other external source. The answers come from the boy himself.
And no one having taught him, only asked questions, yet he will know, having got knowledge out of himself.
At this point, the dialogue with Meno shifts back to the question from which it started. What is the relation between ethics and knowledge? Plato suggests that ethical knowledge can be recovered from the self through questioning. Accordingly, it must be related to knowledge at a more general and basic level. But what is this relation? Socrates prods Meno to consider the ethical qualities that are usually valued most highly: justice, courage, temperance. Isn't it true, Socrates asks, that they all presuppose at least one thing in common? Knowledge.
For example, courage. If courage does not involve intelligence, would not the boldness associated with courage turn into foolhardiness? Isn't it true that to be confident without reason does a man harm, whereas reasoned confidence helps him?
Plato makes a common sense point. It'd be foolish never to back away from a situation. In some circumstances, to back away, even to run away, is the prudent, the right thing to do. A genuinely courageous man will recognize this. Courage, then, consists in knowing what to fear and what not to fear, and then acting on that knowledge. The same argument applies to all other moral virtues. Knowledge also has a central role in each. And if virtue presupposes knowledge, then, Plato seems to conclude, virtue can be taught. Even the most forgetful soul should be able to remember virtue, and this would be true for everybody. No one is unteachable. The discussion between Socrates and Meno, however, doesn't end with this conclusion. Socrates is still not convinced that Meno fully understands what it means to teach somebody something. He proves this to the reader and to Meno by seeming to contradict his own first answer, that virtue can be taught. Then Socrates watches how Meno reacts. Plato now argues for what seems to be the opposite conclusion from his earlier position. If virtue is knowledge and can be taught, he challenges Meno, surely there ought to be people who teach it. But in fact, as we look around Athens, we don't find such teachers. Indeed, there are people who claim to teach ethics, but they don't really do this. Their students frequently turn out badly. Indeed, even the children of good parents often turn out to be unjust. It seems obvious if anyone would want to instill ethical values, parents would want to instill them in their children. Contrary to the first conclusion, then, common perception tells us that virtue's not, in fact, taught. It does not seem to be knowledge, and Socrates questions Meno on this point.
Can you name any other subject in which the professed teachers are not only not recognized as teachers of others, but are thought to have no understanding of it themselves, and to be no good at the very subject they profess to teach? When people are so confused about a subject, can you say that they are in a true sense teachers?
With this question, the dialogue draws to an abrupt close. Meno, and we as well, are left hanging. We are left to ponder the apparent contradiction that Plato seems to have asserted. Virtue both can and cannot be taught. Virtue both is and is not knowledge. But Plato's left a clue in his text, a clue which Meno himself in the dialogue misses. In the first part of their discussion, Socrates and Meno consider the relation between ethics and knowledge in general. They don't discuss the specific knowledge that's required to be good or just. When Socrates later asserts that there are no teachers of ethics, however, he's referring specifically to the people who pass for teachers in Athens. That they are not true teachers doesn't mean that there could not be others who are. Socrates himself has taught geometry to the slave boy. In the same way, he's taught ethics to the Athenians, by his own example and by questioning. For Plato's audience here, the message is clear. Ethics is a form of knowledge, and it can be taught. But we must first understand what knowledge is. We must genuinely understand what it means to teach and to learn. It's easy to be mistaken about both knowledge and learning. Socrates has shown Meno and us how at least some of our common mistakes can be avoided.
This is the end of tape number 1 on Plato. The presentation is continued on tape 2.